This week on Making Contact.
You will hear bottled water companies say that they're just another user like a farmer or a manufacturer, but they're not, because they're asserting private ownership of a public resource.
Probably half the cost of desalinating water is the cost of energy.
Water, it's the source of all life. 70% of the planet is covered in it. More than half of your body is made up of it. We use water every day to refresh, revive, to subsist. Yet water resources are growing increasingly scarce around the world, and access to potable water, alarmingly difficult in some regions. On this special edition, we take a look at some core water issues affecting people around the world. I'm Tina Rubio, your host for Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. When most people think of Hawaii, they think of an island paradise with lush vegetation and majestic waterfalls. But since Westerners settled the islands in the 19th century, the issues surrounding Hawaii's critical and fragile water resources have been a source of deep division and debate. During Hawaii's plantation era, five sugar companies controlled virtually every aspect of working people's daily lives, including employment, housing, banking, and politics. They wielded so much power, they were known as the Big Five. To irrigate their sugar fields, the companies constructed massive irrigation systems to carry water away from natural streams. These diversions immediately impacted native Hawaiian tradition and culture, like growing taro, a root vegetable that grows best in running water. But the Hawaiian economy has shifted, and now only one sugar company remains on Maui. Yet those sugar companies from the past still control the water. But as Making Contact's Robin Takayama reports, some communities are fighting back to take control of their water.
My name is Duke Sevilla. I'm from Maui, born and raised here in Maui. And this area is our property. When the water was flowing, people was grazing taro, watercress, unchoy, and sometimes people even raised some rice down in here before.
Duke walks down a dirt path pointing to where crops of food once grew. He continues through a forest of tea plants, coconut trees, and banana trees until he arrives at a 20-foot-wide barren hole in the ground, a spring with no water in it.
The reason why we stopped because the water. We didn't have any more water.
Duke's property is in central Maui, in an area called Nawai'eha, or the Four Great Waters. Before Westerners arrived, four streams flowed from the mountains on the west side of Maui through central Maui and into the ocean. Nawai'eha supported farming of Hawaiian staple food, an edible root called taro, and boasted the largest contiguous taro-growing area in all of Hawaii. But on Duke's property, there's no taro, and the spring is dry.
Part of the problem is that water's being taken out at every opportunity.
Kapua Sproat is a lawyer with Earth Justice.
So it's like continually withdrawing money from a bank without ever making a deposit. And that's why we're having problems now.
She says that Wailuku Sugar Company has diverted water from Nawai'eha to their sugar plantations and has taken all of the flow out of the streams and communities. Maui County has also tapped groundwater in the region for domestic drinking water.
And, you know, I told my dad, I said, "Dad, why don't you do something about it?" And he said, son, what can one man do, you know, against the big companies, and it would have cost a lot of money, yeah, to go up against, you know, big companies like Wailuku Sugar, HCNS, and, you know, those kind of companies. And those are the people that control the water at that time. Yeah, and they see it kind of do.
Avery Chumbly is the president of Wailuku Water Company, formerly Wailuku Sugar Company. He says that diverting the water from this region is totally legal.
You have to understand first that the diversions that we do have in place are diversions that have been registered under the state of Hawaii, Hawaii Revised Statutes, State Water Code, and under the Constitution of the state of Hawaii to our company. The second aspect is that these are systems that were built on our lands with an investment of resources of time and personnel and money going back 100 and some years.
when those water systems were developed way back when and the agreements were made, sugarcane was a very, very integral part of the economy of the counties. And sugarcane was providing most of the income for the families.
That's Alan Arakawa, mayor of Maui County.
They were given concessions to be able to utilize a lot of the water that was basically the public water for the irrigation of sugarcane, and to be able to continue their process in order to be able to keep the economy viable. Now, since that time, Wailuku Sugar Company has gone out of existence. They no longer raise sugarcane. They're a water company now. Should they still control all the water and the water rights?
Hawaii has a state water code that says the State Water Commission must protect the water and make sure it is used to the benefit of the people. Benefits include domestic drinking water, maintenance of the water in its natural state, and exercise of Native Hawaiian tradition and customs. Many believe this water code should be used to determine the best use of the water and serve as a guide on whether Wailuku Water Company should be allowed to maintain the diversions. But Kapua says that in practice, the state water code has amounted to very little.
It's been incumbent upon community groups to really hold the State Water Commission's feet to the fire and force them to enforce the law.
Inspired by his father's lament, "What can one man do?" Duke Sevilla and his neighbors formed Hui Onawai Eha. The Hui wants to see stream flow return to the four streams so that the water runs all the way from the mountains to the ocean. They've used the legal tools provided by the state water code to pressure the state to enforce the law and care for this public resource. They filed a petition to the State Water Commission to restore stream flow. They filed a petition to investigate claims that Wailuku Water Company is illegally dumping the water they divert. And they filed a petition so that anyone who wants to use the water from the local aquifer may be challenged. They've also educated the public so that people understand why it's important to have streams flow from Mauka to Makai, or from the mountains to the ocean.
There was a cool ecosystem here where, you know, we used to have o'opu, opai, you know, small freshwater shrimp, but now we don't have any of that. And in the ocean, you know, we used to have a lot more fish in it, where we live, and now, you know, if you go into the ocean, you don't see a lot of it. Why? It's because you have to have the nutrients from the freshwater to, you know, feed the seaweed, and also for all the fishes to come around, because they would thrive off all the nutrients that came down from the freshwater, like the shrimp, the o'opu. And the shrimp and the o'opu, they have to go to the salt water to, you know, to spawn and then to come back up again.
Having Mauka to Makai stream flow in each of these streams not only benefits our clients and the public at large, it also significantly benefits Maui County and the Department of Water Supply, because having water in the streams helps to recharge their wells.
Maui County has had problems meeting the drinking water demands for a dramatically expanding population. Besides tapping into the local aquifer, they purchase up to 3.2 million gallons of water a day from Wailuku Water Company. The former sugar company has been steadily liquidating its assets for several years. Kapua says that the only assets the company has left are the 18,000 acres of watershed land where the irrigation ditch system diverts the water.
And many people are concerned that, being a company whose primary interest is the financial bottom line, that Wailuku Water is now going to look at marketing that company to the highest bidder. And I think that's a significant concern for the county administration, that they already have such a difficult time dealing with a company based right there in Maui. What kind of problems are they going to have if they're dealing with a board of directors based in Geneva or Paris or someone else who has really no interest in what the needs of the people of Maui are and what impact that may have on Hawaiian culture or the public trust?
When asked if international water companies have expressed interest in purchasing Wailuku Water Company, President Chumbly responded, "No comment." He claims that Maui County is actually saving money by purchasing water from this private source. He says that by merely paying for the use of the Wailuku Water Company ditch system, local authorities do not have to find new sources and drill new wells.
The public needs water for consumption, for home use, for whatever purposes. So if government can buy that water, buy that service of the delivery of the water at a substantially discounted price, then it's a good thing for the taxpayer because they've saved money.
But Maui County officials disagree. In June, the mayor signed a budget for the 2006-2007 year that includes $7.2 million to buy the watershed lands from Wailuku Water Company. They will do this either through direct purchase or by condemning the land, taking the property for public use with just compensation. At least that's the plan.
The county has really shown the initiative and the willingness to do whatever it takes, including exercising its power of condemnation if necessary, in order to return to public control public trust resources that for the last 150 years have been manipulated by private corporations.
Maui County is hiring an appraiser to determine the fair value of the property. And once control of the ditch system is obtained, the county will restore mountain-to-ocean stream flow. But it's a safe bet that the story of control over water resources in Maui County is just beginning. For Making Contact, I'm Robin Takayama in Maui.
It's no secret, a global crisis over access to water is brewing. The United Nations reports 1 billion people lack access to safe drinking water. 31 countries face water shortages. And as the global population increases, the abundance of water decreases. So the debate continues to boil over whether water should be owned and operated privately or publicly. And the answers you get are just as complex and varied as the issue. Jeffrey Siegel is the director of privatization and government reform at the Reason Foundation, a Los Angeles-based nonprofit that advocates water privatization. He says overall, privatization has been a success.
Again, the overwhelming majority, upwards north of 93-94% of cases are pretty successful. And you name another business that if they had a 94% success rate would be deemed a failure, and I'm willing to suggest that you wouldn't find a single one.
Siegel goes on to say,
globally, yes, there have been a few very high-profile failures, but I think that we've learned from those mistakes. I mean, the World Bank considers the private sector and water privatization critical to the success of delivering clean water and safe water throughout the world, especially in developing countries.
But opponents say privatization does anything but that, leaving many around the world high and dry.
In the developing world, the failures are because they're basically trying to take the water into parts of the community that are more affluent. So they're not actually delivering water to the poor. And when you have countries where people live on $1 or $2 a day, they can't afford to pay high prices for their water.
That's Winona Hodder, director of Food and Water Watch in Washington, D.C., a nonprofit watch group. Hodder likens privatization to the service issues associated with U.S. phone companies.
It's the whole issue of having a multinational company come in to your local water system and try to manage it. Here in the U.S., we've had the same situation with the phone companies where you'll have, you can't get repairs made, you're calling someone hundreds of miles away to report a problem. They have no familiarity with your community. So it's just this long-distance management, and it's the whole profit motive that is behind the failures.
Siegel concedes that private companies are out to make a buck, but says it's in the best interest of those companies to provide a good service. Those good services being safe, potable water, something he says public water operators don't always do.
EPA data shows that private operation actually leads to a lower rate of EPA violations. Public operators have a higher rate of violating EPA's own standards. So at least here in the United States, where initiatives are properly managed, there is strong accountability mechanisms, and there is strong performance incentives. The private providers have outperformed public ones.
Private or public, the goal remains the same, providing potable water at a reasonable cost. But at what cost? Hodder says giving up control of water resources is a price not worth paying.
I think that if citizens are vigilant, that we don't have to move into the type of world where our aquifers and our water systems and our lakes and rivers are privatized. But without that vigilance and citizen involvement, that's the direction we're going, because the desire to profit from resources is so great.
We'll have more in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like a free listener packet about water, or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. Every year, water is drained out of the Great Lakes on or near the U.S.-Canadian border. It's taken for agriculture, industry, and public drinking supplies. But as Great Lakes Radio Consortium senior editor Lester Graham reports, there are many ways that water is used and shipped out of the Great Lakes Basin, but few ways are more controversial than bottled water.
I'm watching big, clear blue water bottles, the kind you see on water coolers, bouncing along on a conveyor to be washed and then filled with water. Chuck Swartzel is the president of Vesco Water Treatment.
We treat it, it's well water, we treat it, purify it with reverse osmosis, sanitize it, and filter it and bottle it.
Vesco also bottles water in smaller containers, the kind you might buy at a convenience store. All of Vesco's customers are within the Great Lakes Basin, so the water will eventually make its way back to the lakes. But some bottlers distribute water far outside the basin. One of PepsiCo's Aquafina bottled water plants gets its water from the Detroit River, which connects the upper Great Lakes to the lower lakes. Aquafina's bottled water is distributed inside and outside the basin. That means Great Lakes water is being trucked away. It's a net loss of water to the basin. That's not anything new. Water from the Great Lakes Basin in the form of beer from Milwaukee or milk from Minnesota or any of the other products you can think of that are mostly water are shipped far and wide and have been for a long time. But some environmentalists say trucking bottled water away is different. They argue it's a lot like a recent attempt to take tanker ships of Lake Superior water to Asia. It's not a value-added product that's made from water. It's just water. Bill Lobenhurst is a lobbyist for the Michigan Soft Drink Association. He says bottled water is a value-added product, just like many of the others.
Indeed, there's a lot more water in lumber, for example, Christmas trees, and sometimes with a lot less value added to it, too. You don't have to do that much to cut it and ship it. Cherries, baby food, other non-consumable products like paint. What about the water we have to put in the automobile radiators? I really don't know that there is a distinction there. It seems to be more of a misplaced perception than it is any kind of environmental reality.
I guess I'm having a hard time getting my head around the difference between shipping water out by a truckload of bottles and shipping it out by tanker. What's the real difference there?
I think the difference is that there's the fear that if it's by tanker in those quantities, that it could be abused. If it's in bottles, it's really quite controllable because there's so much more value added to put it in small bottles.
Not everyone is buying that argument. Dave Dempsey is the Great Lakes advisor for the environmental group Clean Water Action. He says the most recent debates about water withdrawal started when that shipping company planned to take about 156 million gallons a year to Asia. Dempsey says a single new bottled water plant trucks away even more than that.
The Nestle project, the single project in Michigan that has been sited and is operating, takes 168 million gallons per year. So the volumes can be greater in bottles than in tankers.
But that's still not that much water compared to other uses. According to figures in a report by the Great Lakes Commission, the cities and industries around the Great Lakes withdraw more than 43 billion gallons a day. Much of it is used and returned to the lakes, but nearly 2 billion gallons a day is lost. It's not returned to the lakes because it evaporates or it's incorporated into products. 2 billion gallons a day makes Nestle's bottled water plant's 168 million gallons a year seem minor. But Dave Dempsey argues there's a more sinister concern. He believes if water is treated like any other commodity, large corporations that can profit from it will begin to hoard it and control it.
You will hear bottled water companies say that they're just another user like a farmer or a manufacturer or even a city water supply, but they're not, because they're asserting private ownership of a public resource. And if we essentially allow that by not putting controls on the water for sale industry now, I'm afraid the Great Lakes may become the world's largest privately owned reservoir.
A recent agreement between the states and provinces around the Great Lakes allows bottled water to be shipped out in bottles as large as 5 gallons. But some environmentalists say that agreement is a slippery slope. They say corporations will soon be asking, why just 5 gallons? Why not 55-gallon barrels? And then tankers. The bottling industry says the environmentalists are making a big deal out of nothing and would do better spending their time teaching everyone to conserve water instead of complaining about someone in another state quenching their thirst with a bottle of water from the Great Lakes.
That was Lester Graham, senior editor of the Great Lakes Radio Consortium. Many parts of the world are looking to solve their water problems by tapping the Earth's largest water supply, the ocean. Desalination, the technology used to extract salt out of seawater, producing high-quality drinking water, is getting more affordable by the year, and is experiencing explosive growth in some parts of the world. But environmental groups are sounding a cautious note about reliance on the technology. Making Contact's Brian Edwards Tiekert has the story.
The Alameda County Water District in Northern California has had water problems for nearly a century. At first, farmers pumped the water they needed for irrigation from wells drilled into an underground aquifer. But as the pressure dropped underground, salt water started to move in from the San Francisco Bay. Carl Stinson is the agency's operations manager.
Because of the previous seawater intrusion from overpumping the groundwater basin for decades back in the early 1900s, we were left with pockets of this brackish groundwater.
Now, the water district is trying to fix its aquifer by pumping out the pockets of salty water. Meantime, the district has had to buy most of its drinking water from out of town.
We buy water from the State Water Project, and that water comes out of the Delta into the South Bay.
Problem is, says Stinson, water from out of town isn't always reliable.
If we had another dry year like in 1977, we would only get 5% of our contract from the Delta, from the state.
So, with self-reliance in mind, the district looked to the salty water it was already pumping out of the ground. The Alameda County Water District turned to a technology called desalination.
We have wells off-site, the brackish groundwater wells. They pump it to the site here. Then we have booster pumps that are required to pump it through the reverse osmosis membranes.
In 2003, the agency built a plant that takes the brackish water being pumped out of the ground and basically squeezes the salt out of it. What comes out the other end is two things, a saltier discharge that drains into the San Francisco Bay, and this. That's highly purified water with less salt in it than the mountain snowmelt that feeds neighboring San Francisco's water system. The plant can currently pump up to 5 million gallons a day into the area's drinking supply, and the district plans to double its size in the next year. The biggest expense for the district is energy. The cost of running the pumps that pressurize the system drives the price per gallon over 3 times higher than what the district pays for water pumped in from out of town. And as water-starved towns up and down the West Coast consider building much larger desalination plants to take on the even more energy-intensive task of desalinating ocean water, that has some public advocates concerned.
Probably half the cost of desalinating water is the cost of energy. And unfortunately, at the moment, the cost of energy is going up, not down.
Peter Glick directs the Pacific Institute, which released a 100-page report on desalination earlier this year. He's worried that communities looking for an easy fix to water shortages may get locked into contracts with private companies running increasingly expensive desalination plants.
And it's far more cost-effective to improve the efficiency of water use, in especially the western United States, than to build another dam or to build a big desalination plant. It's just far cheaper to cut our wasteful use.
But industry experts say innovations are bringing the cost of desalination down steadily. Rick Stover is the Chief Technology Officer at Energy Recovery, Inc., a privately held company that makes devices that improve the energy efficiency of desalination plants.
Currently, with modern technology, high-efficiency pumps, the latest membranes, and the latest energy recovery devices, you can produce water for about 60 cents per 1,000 gallons energy consumption. So to further put that into perspective, relative to the cost of using river water, the water from the California aqueduct that goes to Southern California costs about 93 cents per 1,000 gallons in energy consumption.
Like most of the environmental groups who are wary of the new technology, he says desalination plants have to be evaluated on a site-by-site basis to figure out if they can operate efficiently without harming the environment.
One of the things that's being considered, and I think it's been, in fact, recommended by a number of environmental groups, is to site reverse osmosis plants together with power plants, either existing power plants or new power plants to be built. And one of the advantages of doing this, especially with regard to siting desalination facilities at existing power plants, is that intakes and outfalls will typically already be in place. So a lot of times a desalination plant can just take some of the water that's already being pulled from an intake, purify that water, and then discharge.
But that proposal to combine desal plants with older power plants is precisely what has many environmental groups concerned. For years, many environmentalists have been struggling to shut down power plants using an older technology called once-through cooling. Those plants suck up hundreds of millions of gallons of water, which kills marine life and wipes out fish eggs. Then they discharge it as warmer water, which can upset local ecologies. And that's precisely the kind of power plant that desalination advocates want to piggyback on. Connor Everts directs California's statewide desal response group.
At the 11th hour, after they've been working on this for almost 30 years, suddenly desal shows up and calls itself a beneficial use. The power plant operator, when we were on a tour for the state task force on desal, actually said, "I'm so glad desal's here because we thought we'd be going out of business."
In the end, Everts says, desalination will see widespread use. And he doesn't have a problem with that. But he's alarmed at how many proposals for massive facilities he sees moving toward approval on the West Coast right now.
Two plants in Carlsbad, to Huntington Beach in Orange County, to even little Cambria, to two in the Moss Landing area at the power plant there, total of nine in the Monterey Bay, to one in Marin County.
With that many plants in the works, Connor Everts is concerned they won't all get the environmental and economic scrutiny they need. And environmental advocates say most areas would be better served by ratcheting up their water conservation efforts rather than building massive new plants. For Making Contact, I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert in Berkeley, California.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. For the hour-long version of this show, please go to radioproject.org. Special thanks to engineers Stephanie Welch and Mike Lamar, to Lester Graham, senior editor of GLRC, and to Dan Turner, Ronald Recker, and Steve Macer. For a CD copy of program number 3406, or for a free listener packet about water, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736, or go to radioproject.org. Lisa Redman is our executive director, Dorian Taylor, communications manager, Stefana Petrova, production intern, and I'm your host and senior producer, Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.